So it's now 2:02. I think we'll get the call started. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to mute all the lines so we can get rid of all this extra noise. Then we'll open it up later for questions. And when I do, I'm going to ask everybody to mute their own phone by pressing *6 unless you're asking a question. So I'm going to mute the lines now.
All guests have been muted. You can unmute your line by pressing *6.
Okay, so this is Tim Brennan. I'm Treasurer Chief Financial Officer at the Unitarian Universalist Association and a member of the Investment Committee. And we also have with us today Lucia Santini-Field, who is the Chair of the Investment Committee, and David Stewart, who is a member of the Investment Committee and the Chair of the Socially Responsible Investing Committee. Our outlook is to look at the performance overview of the fund. Lucia will take that. We'll talk a little bit about the outlook. We're going to talk about the actions at the most recent Investment Committee meeting, which was on March 8th. We're going to talk about the SRI committee action. David will present that, and then we'll open it up for questions from you all. So before we launch into that, let me just cover the administrative stuff and say that we have now successfully transitioned all the accounts from the UUA to the UU Common Endowment Fund LLC. So this is the separate legal entity that now holds all the assets of the fund, including the UUA's assets. To remind you, we did this in order to provide better liability protection for the congregation. The other thing that will be different is that our auditors will be conducting a separate audit and issuing a separate report for the endowment fund, which again I think will provide a greater level of assurance to the investing congregations. And thanks to Susan Helbert, we were able to reach all of the investing congregations, so that's something like 330 congregations with 400 plus accounts. Now we reached all except five, and those five had their funds returned to them. If you run across them anywhere, you can tell them they're always welcome to come back, but we needed to have the legal documentation in place in order to hold on to those assets, and we didn't want to keep the old structure going. So with that, let me turn it over to Lucia. Lucia, do you want to talk about performance and investment actions?
Sure. And you guys should both feel free to jump in. I'll start with the performance review through the end of February. As everyone knows, it's been a very volatile market environment, primarily in the downward direction, although we've had plenty of strong up days, not enough to erase all of the down days. And the price of oil has been one of the most significant concerns of the market in terms of its impact on the global economy because of the spread of that deflationary impact into other commodities and depressing economies that are based on commodities, as well as the risk to the financial system because of the number of financial institutions that are heavily exposed to energy lending. I think in that regard, European banks are perhaps in generally worse position than U.S. domestic institutions as a whole. The endowment has participated in the downdraft just slightly worse than our allocation index and policy, and that slightly worse, largely the result of underperformance of a couple of managers who have been relatively strong performers over the long term, rather than being attributable to an overweight in any particular category against our allocation index or policy. So although we do have a slight overweight in fixed income for the time being, based on manager changes that we've made, the overweight is not intended to remain there long term, but for the short term, our fixed income on the whole has generally benefited the portfolio's total return, even if it has trailed its benchmark on a specific benchmark specific basis. On a total return for the common endowment fund basis, it has been a positive. The I think largest negatives for the recent past and year to date are the domestic growth managers, who because the year to date the market has punished most significantly assets that are deemed to be higher risk, where those had been perhaps most favored over the long term. In the very near term, they have been more heavily punished, and so both our large cap growth managers and small cap growth managers have struggled a bit on a recent basis against their benchmarks, although their longer term performance has been quite strong.
Lucia, can I just jump
mm-hmm.
in and just
yeah, I was going to ask
out.
If you wanted to add anything.
Yeah, particularly with our large cap growth manager Sands, this is a manager who does not. They're not trying to match the benchmark. It's a high conviction portfolio, which means they only have about 25 or 30 names, and they're trying to buy into companies when the value is low. And so over the long term, they've done a great job of outperforming, but they kind of do that by jumping into positions that may be on the way down with the thought that they believe that over the long term they're going to outperform. So
yes,
it's not unusual for them to vary significantly from the benchmark in any given period. We try to focus on the long-term performance.
And that's a very important note to make. All of the managers in the portfolio have been selected based on their long-term track record and our expectations for their performance over the long term. The choice of benchmark is the most appropriate benchmark for the strategy, but doesn't necessarily imply that that their performance should be close to the benchmark at every point in the market cycle. Indeed, active managers have styles that are designed to perform differently than the benchmark, generally in different portions of a market cycle and in a highly concentrated strategy. As Tim has pointed out, they're really looking at long-term value and not downside protection.
Yeah, and that's in sharp contrast to the Rumline portfolio, which is actually a custom index. So it's designed to track the Russell 1000 value, and actually has hundreds of positions. So it does track that index pretty closely because that's what it's trying to do.
And that is an exception in the portfolio, which is largely comprised of active managers. And Rumline, by design, is an index manager that was selected to assist in the category where we would expect to get the most from indexing, and where we could complement the ESG objectives of the common endowment in the most robust way. David or Tim, do you have any other things you'd like to add about recent performance?
I don't, except that I wish it were better.
I would have added something, just that, not that I really want to talk much about China, but there has been downdrafts from Asia as well. So.
Yes, and that is expected to continue as that economy, which is a very large as a participant in the global economy, relatively smaller in terms of impact directly on the U.S. economy, but ultimately they're at the beginning of a significant transition in their economy from producer to moving gradually in a more service direction over, I think, a very long time. And economic transitions can be difficult for any economy, but I think particularly a very large economy that is trying to straddle a market-based approach and marry it to a more centralized, controlled approach is a big challenge.
So, Lucia, I'm going to actually ask a question instead of make a comment. But the thing that jumps out, I think, is that is our large exposure to international, which is underperforming domestic. And do you want to talk a little bit about why the committee has maintained that conviction?
Well, actually, I heard you did it recently so well. I would turn that to you because I do think that
okay.
was one of the questions, and then I'll chime in.
Okay, I'm happy to do that. So the committee long ago looked at the global investable universe. In other words, where is the market cap that an active investor can put their money? And it's actually there's quite a bit more outside of the United States than in the United States. So we have a balance here of about 50-50 between the U.S. and the rest of the world. But if you looked at the markets, they're actually weighted much more towards the rest of the world. Historically, a lot of investors have had what's called a domestic bias, and that means they weight more towards the U.S. But that really exposes you to a lot of fluctuation. These days, if you look at valuations, the valuations of international companies tend to be much lower than those in the U.S., even though the potential for return and growth is quite strong. So, we don't try to time market cycles. We're in a market cycle right now where international is undervalued compared to domestic. But we believe in maintaining those exposures and believe it will, over the longer term, come back and benefit us.
And, I guess, so the only other thing that I might chime in there is simply that from an underlying economic standpoint, Europe has only recently begun to implement the kind of steps that we implemented years ago to strengthen our economic recovery, and are in the very early stages of showing improvement. Obviously, their economy is very differently structured and has a different set of challenges, but they have recently taken steps that most players inside and outside do expect will have similarly favorable results over the longer term.
Yeah, maybe the last thing I'd say is that, you know, it's sometimes, particularly in these bad markets, it's hard to continue to be forward-looking and not second-guess and be backward-looking. But we, with our consultant, New England Pension Consultants, look at a long-term outlook for different asset classes and the long-term outlook for equities is strongest for emerging markets. And second strongest for international developed markets and less for U.S. markets. So it's really with that in mind that we maintain these exposures because we think that's where you know, future returns will come, which is not to say it's going to come next month or even this year, but over the 5 to 7 year time horizon, that's where the returns will be according to our consultants, and we take that advice.
Yeah, this perfectly exemplifies in my mind that past performance does not imply anything about future performance. And I think it's important to note that the U.S. has had a really strong run, and to assume that it would keep running this way would not be necessarily prudent.
And the U.S.'s run was really kindled by the exact moves that that Europe has been implementing. Okay, so shall we open it up for questions there before we move to the outlook and expectations and then investment committee review? Or
sure, that'd be fine, if that's what you'd like to do. So everybody actually has the ability to unmute their own line by pressing *6. So if you press *6, you can ask a question, and I would ask that when you're done asking the question, you press *6 again so we don't get a lot of ambient noise.
I have a question.
And who is this?
McGill Tenney in Castine, Maine, with the Castine Unitarian Church.
Go ahead, Gil.
And part of this has to, and we're, as you might remember, we're fairly newcomers to your portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
My question has to do with some of the terms in your policy, such as moderate risk tolerance over longer terms. And when I look at that, first of all, I have trouble equating definition of moderate. If I don't know if you have a measurement to quantify that. And longer term is probably easier to define. And I suspect it might be in a 3 to 5 year period.
Yeah, I would say longer term is more like 5 to 7 years. So that's the time frame that NEPC covers when they do their market outlooks. And as far as the risk goes, we
I think the easiest measure to point to in that regard is volatility of returns,
right,
and
exactly.
The volatility of returns and the contribution to the portfolio's total return and total volatility is something that the committee considers very carefully, and so this portfolio is it's a long-term portfolio, so it's obviously invested in long-term asset classes. But but the mix selection and the particular managers selected are designed to reduce overall volatility of returns relative to the market.
Yeah, there's actually a slide I wish we had included in the book, and we will next time, that graphically shows where our portfolio is when compared to the universe. And so, and what it shows is there's kind of the dead middle of it is the universe median, and we sit a little bit below that. So that, again, this is measuring annualized standard deviation. So our deviation is lower than that, and it's well lower than the, say, the S&P 500. So, you know, we're at something just a little bit below 7, and if you look at the S&P, it's going to be more up in the teens. So that's what we mean by less volatility. Yeah.
But moderate risk is really being measured in a variety of ways, but volatility and standard deviation of returns are an important way because most organizations who are investors in the Common Endowment Fund and, of course, also the UUA are fairly dependent on a stream of cash flows out of the endowment, and the volatility of returns and the ability to lessen that is very important to protecting the longer term ability to generate those cash flows.
Okay. I understand. I do have a follow-up a question on related to this, but I don't want to hog up the line here. The follow-up would be, you just said a little while ago that the strongest value is in foreign emerging markets, and the next strongest value would be in the more developed foreign markets. Seems to me that there is, particularly in the emerging markets, there's considerable volatility. You've got, you know all the factors better than I.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. There is more volatility in emerging markets, right?
Yeah, and I would almost think that if you're managing money for churches who are sometimes living paycheck to paycheck, so to speak, that you'd want to take just a very small exposure and maybe even give up some of the upside potential on the emerging markets.
And the emerging markets exposure in the endowment is relatively small. The percentage of the portfolio right now is just about 7%. But I think what Tim was commenting on is the long-term expected return based on current prices and likely future path of GDP and earnings growth in those areas, and underlying prices of securities in those markets.
Okay.
Yeah, and you sort of anticipated also when we get to the discussion of the investment committee meeting, but I'll maybe a little spoiler alert. So the committee tends to make changes in allocations pretty gradually. We're not herky jerky. We're not saying, okay, we're 8% in equity markets and now we're zero. We have come down from 8% to 7% in emerging markets. And at the meeting, we talked about going down another percent to 6. So it's really, and it has to do, as you said, to do with the volatility. So that will take a while to actually implement, but over the next few months we will be bringing that down just a little bit more.
Another thing that we do to manage that kind of cash flow requirement is, in the last meeting we also discussed what our ongoing needs, our distribution needs were. So that's certainly something that we keep in mind when we allocate to these various buckets of, you know, like an international or various types of investments, is that we have sufficient cash flows on hand for the obligations that we have. So that's certainly a consideration that's kind of over and above what we'd ever do with allocations.
So again, star six to open up your line and ask a question of Lucia.
Yeah, this is Frank Tappan, Topeka. In looking through the charts here, I had a couple of questions. I don't see anything about fees. Can you tell me about what the fees are on the average? And
yeah, sure.
Secondly, I wondered about the difference between the year-to-date and the fiscal year-to-date.
Okay, the second one, I'll do that first. The fiscal year starts on July 1st. The year starts on January 1st.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I didn't say that right. The fiscal year, it's July 1st. The 1 year is the previous 12 months.
Okay.
And the year to date is January 1 to present. So it's
right,
it
exactly.
is a lot of moving periods.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
And I just blanked on the
first. The fees he was questioning.
Oh, fees.
The fees.
Yeah. So the fees, the fees vary widely that we pay the managers. It goes from a low of about 0.12% for the index fund, the Rumline fund, and goes up to about 1.4% for the fund of funds, the hedge fund of funds. When you blend it all together, it comes out to about 0.6%. And then there are other expenses that the fund incurs. As I mentioned, we have our investment consultant. That's about 0.1%. We have custodial bank, a little bit of legal, audit fee,
valuation
fee, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And that all adds up to about 0.8%. So everything up to 0.8%. And then the UUA itself charges 0.2% to manage the fund. So we have, you know, several staff people here who work on this full time. And all in, it's right around 1%. Last year it was a shade under. As I recall, it was 0.98%. But it varies around that. But it's not a flat fee except for the 0.2%. Everything else is just the cost of the running the funds that is allocated proportionally across all the funds and then passed through to investors.
Who is the investment consultant?
New England Pension Consultant.
NEPC, located here in Boston / Cambridge.
Okay.
And as a reference point, that consultant manages approximately, what is it? Is it, I want to say nearly $1 trillion for their various clients.
Yeah, that's about right. They're one of the, you know, handful of leading institutional investors.
He's on a conference call with three
in the United States.
Well, your portfolio has done better than mine in the past year, so I have no.
I'm sorry to hear that. Okay. Any other questions? Star six, and then please do star six again to mute your line after you ask your question.
Hi, this is Ann Thorwood. I just would ask that you all identify, Lucy, and pretty much know the fellows if you identify yourself when you start talking. That's very helpful. Thank you.
Sorry about that. I will do that. This is Tim.
Okay, so with that, maybe we should move to...
I have one question. Relative to the portfolio diversification, I'm wondering, would it be fair to say that the international allocation is really somewhat higher than set forth if you take into account what I would assume would be the fact that some, if not many, of the domestic holdings would have large international operations and income from international?
Yeah, and the reverse is true also. You know, there are European companies that have huge operations here. So that's not what it means. Where is the security traded? That's what's being reflected.
Yeah, it's and the currency impact
yes.
of those because indeed for the most part, it's the portfolio is much more heavily weighted to the largest companies, whether we're talking about U.S. domestic or international. There's a heavier weighting to large cap than small cap, and regardless of location, those are global companies.
So your percentage is based on where they're traded?
The issuer's market, the issuer's home market.
Yes, and so this is using exactly the same methodology that is used throughout the industry. So if you go buy a Fidelity domestic equity fund, that's the criteria they're using for the companies that are in that fund. And likewise, if you're looking at a State Street, international index fund, that's how they're defining it as well. So we're being consistent with, industry definition.
And so companies, just in terms of thinking about the impacts, companies all hedge their currency exposures in their global operations, but investment managers may or may not. More of them don't, and I don't believe that UUA is at present utilizing any managers whose strategy actively involves hedging.
Yeah, we do not at this point, although one is under
being
consideration.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's transition briefly to the outlook and expectations, and then we can talk a little bit about the investment committee meeting just earlier this month. I wish I could say that the outlook was for a much calmer and market with a return to the lack of volatility that we became accustomed to perhaps a few years ago. But I think the reality is that we have returned to an era of market volatility that is fairly similar to the one that we, I think, experienced for most of my 30-year career in this business, with the exception of the last 7 or 8 years, largely driven by quantitative easing. And as the Fed has moved away from that, mostly in word and not in deed, but their words are so powerful that that the market has returned to the kind of volatility that has been the norm. And I think we are all expecting that that will persist into the future and perhaps even worsen a little, and this is my own personal view, that the election cycle can spike volatility when there's greater uncertainty than is in terms of who the candidates might be or what their policies might be. And so it seems quite possible to me that we could experience increased volatility as we get closer to this election. I do think the longer-term view is that the trend line is positive, but with plenty of noise in the short term in terms of market action and volatility. And David and Tim, please feel free to jump in and throw in any.
I have a question for you, Lucia. Do you think that the greater volatility gives more opportunity for active management?
I do think that greater volatility provides much more opportunity for active management, and that the pattern of over time there are markets where index funds trounce active managers and the other way around, and it, generally speaking, volatility is a better opportunity, provides a better opportunity set for many active strategies.
I would agree, obviously. It seems to me that there's some strong inefficiencies going on right now, just looking at the value side of stocks. So, you know, that there's going to be opportunities going forward as we look at our allocation to try to take advantage of that.
Do you want to go on and talk about the investment committee meeting, Lucia?
Yes, I think David's last comment there was a nice bridge to I think those of you who participated in the last quarterly call will remember that we had reviewed asset allocation and determined that we were interested in adding to the SMID cap area of the market, and in particular SMID cap value. And
what does SMID mean?
Oh, I'm sorry. So SMID is a combination of small and middle capitalization companies, which depending on which index provider you're looking at, I think it's the Russell 2500 is the most common benchmark for what would be considered a SMID cap portfolio. But people have different ranges, but small usually extends from the hundreds of millions into, five, six, seven, sometimes eight billion, and then mid from, maybe seven or eight up into the 20s, and then large cap beyond that. So, in addition, we were also looking for additional diversification in our international managers. And so we had reviewed how many, probably 8 or 10 managers total in a conference call before this last meeting to select finalists who would make presentations at this last meeting. And then the committee interviewed two finalists in each category, and first the international managers and then the SMID value managers. And selected two, which Tim can, because I'm sketchy on the details. Can you remind me about the implementations of these?
Selections? We're working hard on it right now. But the U.S. SMID manager is Wellington Capital Management, and we do hope to begin funding that. April 1st, and then the other one is the Select Equity, the Baxter Street Fund. So that this is a international. It's also a smaller cap, also value tilt, and that we've got the paperwork done, and we're hoping to implement that also April 1st. So we may not fund them 100% at that point, but we're going to be moving into those funds at that point.
And then the committee had the usual discussions of performance and a continuing dialogue about hedge funds, which has been ongoing for some time, and a continuing review of asset allocation and sourcing of flows for new managers, and I think that was pretty much it. Did I miss anything?
Yeah, well, the other thing is that we've decided to leave the Bridgewater Risk Parity Fund.
Yes, which has been a very long-held position in the portfolio under the GTAA category.
Yeah, and it's done a good job of, you know, producing decent returns with relatively low volatility, which what is what it's designed to do. However, there's a bit of management turmoil going on there right now. So one of the top people, a co-CEO, I think, actually is left, and they're bringing in somebody new. So that raises some concern. And then the other thing is that it, the way it's structured, it has done extremely well in a flat and downward trending interest rate environment. But as we see the likelihood, perhaps, for increased interest rates, it tends to get much more volatile in rising interest rates. It can deal with it, but we saw some pretty big swings, and we're seeing one right now. So that's going to be the source of the funding for these two new equity managers.
And yeah, I think in addition to the to Tim's commentary, just the total allocation there had been, I think, uncomfortably high for the committee for a little while, and it the so the decisions that were made in the asset allocation meeting and the that preceded the March meeting, so I guess that was November, are where these decisions largely took place, and this meeting was how to implement.
Correct. Yeah.
And Bridgewater as well had, there was some ability to reduce that to some degree, but the reality is that the minimum on that particular manager is quite high. So it's the decision to trim the entire position was really...
Right. We wouldn't have been allowed to cut it in half, is I think what David is saying.
Exactly, yeah.
Which
we
would have liked. We probably would have liked to do that, but
yes.
But we were rebuffed.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
Could you tell us something about the employment and professional history of the three of you, Tim, Lucia, and David? Are the three of you employees of the UUA?
So I would point you to the investor information memorandum that has really complete biographical information on all the staff and all the members of the committee. I am a full-time employee of the UUA, and Lucia and David are members, volunteer members of the committee, so they are volunteering their time, as do all the members of the committee. So they earn their keep with a nice lunch. That's what they get.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. And just quickly, I mean, Lucia, do you want to say something about your background?
So I'm an investment professional. I'm a CFA, and I've been in the investment management business for nearly 35 years. Managing money for clients with environmental, social, and governance objectives, as well as financial objectives.
My experience is more academic. I've done portfolio construction and other similar types of things with my MBA, as well as teaching classes and that sort of thing in finance. I've been on the SRI committee for the last 6 years and recently joined the investment.
So we welcome any other questions before we turn to David for his committee update.
So *6 to unmute if you have a question.
Okay.
I'm not hearing anything, so yeah, go ahead, David, and then if we have any extra time, we'll open it up again.
Absolutely. So probably the two most relevant and interesting things from the Socially Responsible Investment Committee this time around was a completion of the videos that we've been trying to put out as educational pieces about what the function and role and kind of how we think of ourselves on the Socially Responsible Investment Committee, how we help the UUA guide their investments to increase environmental, social, and governance kind of the highest standards in those areas. As part of that, we have a new human rights screen. Previous to this time, we've had a screen that was labeled community, which included human rights, but which the background on that is that the Holy Land principles kind of exposed the shortcomings of that blended measurement of corporate performance to us. And so what we found is in the fall of 2014, when we were initially being asked to join company or join other investors in lobbying companies to implement the Holy Land principles, which has to do with Israel-Palestine, that we found that it was a flawed request of companies, that we didn't find it to be something that we could get behind, but and we were not the only ones. There were other leading advocates, activists, shareholder activists who did not find that to be a good vehicle to accomplish their stated goals. But in any way, the result of that was to point out to us essentially internally that we had a shortcoming in our human rights screens, that companies that were complicit in various human rights violations were still making it into our Rumline portfolio domestically. And those, we have control of those accounts and the stocks that are in those accounts. And so we, early in 2015, through the summer of 2015, started the discussions in our committee as well as with our consultant to try to implement a new human rights screen that stood alone, that was more sensitive to human rights complicity with companies. And so that has now been implemented, voted on early this month by the Social Responsible Investment Committee, and those stocks that have tripped that screen will be removed out of the portfolio with the deadline of the end of this quarter. As you know, it happens, it also happens to take care of the objectionable stocks that are coming up in the General Assembly business resolution that has to do with Israel-Palestine. Those are they do overlap for the same reasons. They're human rights violations by companies that are collaborating with the Israeli government or the Israeli military to violate Palestinian human rights. And so those are being taken out as a result of the new human rights screen. But it's not limited to Israel-Palestine. There are other areas in the world, other hot spots that are also being taken into account with that new screen. And so those are probably the highlights from the SRI work that we've done recently.
Thanks, David. So there are a few minutes left. If there are any other questions, hit *6. And you can ask your question on any of the topics we've covered.
Hi, I have perhaps
could you, say who you are?
Is it Doug Kerr in
Thanks, Doug.
California? Sure. on perhaps unfairly basic question, which is, in trying to do a socially responsible portfolio, one eliminates a company, and that means stock that's already been sold by the company will not be purchased by us or by others. I'm not sure, I've never understood what difference that makes to the company. They already sold it, they've already got their money.
Yeah. That's a great question. And in fact, I think for the most part, this is not about affecting the companies. This is really about, let's say two things. First is it's about, you know, where do we want to be deriving our returns? How do we want to be making money? And the, probably the most basic one is a screen that was placed in the 70s, which said that we would not buy tobacco companies. And that we did that just because we didn't want to be aligned with tobacco companies. And so it's similar if a company is really a lousy environmental performer, if they've got a lot of violations, we just don't want to be attached to them.
Aligning the investments with the mission of the organization.
Better said, yes. So, but it's not really about affecting the companies. When it comes to affecting the companies, what we do is we are an active shareholder, actually very much like Lucia's company, Walden Asset Management. So we engage with companies on particular issues. We file shareholder resolutions. We work with other investors like Walden, like members of the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, and we use that leverage as investors to put pressure on companies to improve disclosure and to improve practices. So that's really where the leverage is. But the last thing I'd say is, you know, as more and more investors start incorporating environmental, social, and governance factors into their security selection, I believe that the market is actually starting to reward the companies with a higher stock price, with the better performance. And that can be a force for better environmental and social performance by companies across the market.
Yeah, I think what sustainability standards, which I think the UN's PRI has done a very good job of.
What is PRI?
Principles for Responsible Investment. What those have promulgated is a means of directing Wall Street to take a longer-term view and incorporate key considerations into the calculus that previously weren't being considered. So long-term sustainability of various kinds of practices, whether they're governance or environmental or treatment of employees, are being more actively considered.
And there is one paradox with regard to what you were referring to there as well, which is the more shares you own, the louder, you know, as a portion of your portfolio, the louder your voice is when you try to engage with these companies. And so sometimes you'll hear folks say things, well, why don't we just hold the minimum amount of shares and try to, you know, get them to change what they're doing, but not kind of, you know, be getting our hands dirty with those folks. And it truly, it undercuts your argument when you're talking to the companies about them changing their behavior if you're not not willing to put your capital at risk with their management. So that's another small item.
So now I'm confused. I thought that socially responsible investing involved identifying companies that are doing the wrong things and then not buying the stocks of those companies. And so that would be along the lines of, we don't want to make money with people who are doing the wrong things. In the course of your answer, the opposite has been implied, if I understand correctly, which is we want to own stock in companies doing the wrong thing so that we can go lobby them to do the right things, which I think is a fantastic effort. So,
you know,
one, you would not own it, and the other, you would own it.
Yeah.
But
so you've asked a good question, and we're getting into really kind of complex territory here. But generally, you know, when we do the negative screen, when we leave out the companies, we're talking about kind of the bottom dwellers. So it's by market cap, it's maybe the bottom 15 or 18% of the market. But where we're trying to exert influence is on a whole array of companies that are eligible for the portfolio, but may well have, you know, significant areas that could be improved. And it's, you know, and as I say, we can still be working with these companies that are down in the, the 80th percentile, and trying to move them up. So, I mean, Lucia, you guys do this all day. What are your thoughts?
So, I would say that the eliminating of companies from the portfolio is generally viewed as eliminating those that are most dissonant with the mission or goals or objectives of a client, and in this case the UUA's mission, and that the more valuable contribution that the UUA's investment committee through the SRI committee and Tim and his team makes is their active engagement with companies to promote UU values through engagement with those companies about their practices. And so it doesn't necessarily mean selecting bad companies. It just means it means working with the companies that the managers have selected that haven't been eliminated because they're egregious, and where the UUA can make a meaningful difference across a variety of issue areas over time.
I think it's fabulous that you do that, and I think it would do all of us some degree of a service if you, in emails to us, told us what you were doing to shake up these boardrooms and the success you have and with whom we're doing it.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, and we do try to do that. There is a blog on the UUCEF website, and we do put things out through other channels, but I accept that challenge, and I think David would too, and we'll try to figure out how to communicate more and more regularly about all these different activities.
It is an excellent point, because the endowment's performance is not just financial.
Yeah.
So with all that said, we're right up at 3 o'clock now, and I want to respect everybody's time. But I also want to invite anybody who had a question who maybe didn't get it in to just reach out directly to me or to Susan Helbert, we will get back to you with a response to your question, because we welcome questions from the investing congregation. So thank you all so much for participating. Thank you so much, David and Lucia, for giving us your time and participating in this call. Good luck to everybody. Let's hope that the markets get a little bit better over in the coming months. That's how it usually goes, but it's been a rough ride. But hoping for things to look up soon.
Not sure Donald Trump is going to help you there, but we'll see.
No, I don't think so.
All right, thank you.
Bye. Thanks, everybody.